6 years ago, on my birthday, a friend of mine gave me as a gift an authentic boomerang, which is kind of cool. So I took it out in the backyard and threw it, and it never came back to me. Ever since then, I've lived in constant fear. If you see anything coming from that direction, you'll let me know, right? Fear. Fear is kind of a funny thing. That joke wasn't so funny, but fear is kind of a funny thing. Even when I was a little kid, I was fearful about many different things. One of the things I was most fearful about was a roller coaster. When my friends would coax me on the roller coaster, the expression on my face would often look like the expression on this little girl's face. Can't you just feel her pain? Take a look at this guy here. Can you picture yourself doing that? Feet dangling over the cliff, looking down hundreds of feet. I mean, think about it. This guy is just one fart away from certain death. Just one little change of pressure, he's a goner. There are a lot of things to be afraid of in life. But God is not the author of fear. The Bible tells us that point blank, 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, God has not given us a spirit of fear. So, if fear doesn't come from God, where does it come from? And what can fear do to our lives? Today, we're going to launch into a brand new sermon series called Fearless, in which we're going to look at five of the greatest fears that we wrestle with in life. Fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of being alone, fear of lack, fear that there won't be enough. And finally, fifthly, fear of death, fear of illness and death. With each of these five fears, we're going to do two things. Number one, with each, we're going to ask, what would it look like to reframe this fear through the eyes of faith? In other words, how should a person of faith see this area of life, so that hopefully we'll gain more perspective? And then secondly, for each of these fears, we're going to be looking at least one spiritual weapon that we can use to counteract that fear, so that hopefully when we're all done, we'll be in a better position to tame, maybe even conquer our fears. So today, we're going to start with the first, fear of failure. Let's begin with a prayer. God, since we were kids all our lives, we've heard people saying, don't mess up. Be good. Work hard. Succeed. Make us proud. That's a lot of pressure. Pressure that can end up twisting and distorting our lives. We don't want to lose our lives to fear. Show us how we can put fear in its place. How we can be more than conquerors. In Jesus' name, amen. When I was in seventh grade, I got my first great lesson in what failure feels like. Most of you know I come from a basketball crazy family. My mother's brother was a professional basketball player, and so much of our family's life and activities revolved around the success of Uncle Louie. He was my idol. I cut out pictures from the newspaper of Louis in action and plastered them on my bedroom wall. He was my future. I was going to grow up to be Uncle Louis. I was going to be a professional basketball player and make my family as proud of me as they were of Uncle Louis. Early on, that was going pretty well. I made the fifth grade basketball team. I made the sixth grade basketball team. And so it was just assumed I would make the seventh grade basketball team. I'll never forget that morning at school when word began to spread that the names of all the boys who'd made the seventh grade team had been posted on the bulletin board down by the gymnasium. So I made my way down to take a look. I looked, and I looked again. Wait a minute, there must be some mistake. I looked again. My name wasn't on the list. My heart sank into my feet. I felt numb all over. I turned and walked back toward my first period class, sat down at my assigned seat. Paul Jacobs, who sat in front of me, turned around and said, "Did you make the team?" I almost lost control. I almost burst into tears. Not a cool thing to do when you're a seventh grade boy. I took a deep breath, stuffed my feelings deep inside and said, no, I didn't make it. Looked down at my book as if I needed to study, needed to read. All the while, I was thinking to myself, in a few hours, I'm going to have to go home, and I'm going to have to tell my mom, and I'm going to have to tell my dad. I got cut. I failed. I didn't make the team. I felt embarrassed. I felt I had embarrassed my family. And I found myself wondering, what is Uncle Louis going to think of me when he hears that his punk nephew couldn't even make the seventh grade basketball team? And what I felt at that point in my life, it was like in a moment, all that I thought at that point my life was going to be, it came crashing down, and it hurt like Hades. And I found myself thinking and saying, I will never let something like that happen to me again. This will never, ever happen to me. It was like my Gone with the Wind moment, as with God as my witness. This will never happen to me again. Because the pain and the shame of that failure was so great. We've all been there as kids. And worse yet, as adults. Do you know what it feels like to lose your job, to have to go home and tell your family, "I was laid off," or "I was let go"? Or maybe it's a broken relationship, a divorce, and you feel like you've let everybody down. Or maybe you can't meet your bills and you have to go to your family or your friends to ask for a loan, and then there's bankruptcy and you wonder, what's wrong with me? Why am I such a failure? Maybe you start a business and the business comes crashing down. Maybe it's addiction. Why can't I control myself? Why can't I keep from shooting up? Maybe it's a moral lapse. Cheating on a spouse. Betraying a friend. Fraud. Stealing at work. Shoplifting. I once counseled a woman who was a journalist, had a great reputation in the community, married, had a young child. She had everything going for her until she got arrested for shoplifting. Convicted. Lost her career. Lost her reputation, lost everything. Her sense of serenity, her sense of self, her sense of worth all came crashing down. It hurt like Hades. And when we feel that, we say to ourselves, I will never let something like this happen to me again with God as my witness. And that can then cause us to yield to the temptation to pull back in life. It can cause us to yield to the temptation to play it safe, to only engage in activities where we're guaranteed that we're going to succeed. And so our horizon, the horizon of our life, shrinks. It grows smaller and smaller. And when we start living like that, fear has already won. And fear does not come from God. Years ago, I had a big barrel-chested chocolate lab. We named her Truffle. Truffle soon became Truffy for short, and then Truffy transmuted into Tuffy, but Tuffy was anything but tough. I have never had a dog that was afraid of more things than Tuffy was. One of her big phobias was of walking on linoleum. So I'd bring her here to the church with me sometimes, and I'd walk out of my office down the hallway, which is all, the hallway's all linoleum. She would walk to the edge of the carpet and start to shiver. And she so wanted to go where I was going. So she would whine and shiver. And I would literally have to go back and pick up this 60-pound dog and carry her to where she wanted to be. What a powerful metaphor for what happens to us when we allow fear to control us in life. It makes our lives small. It shrinks us down. It causes us to lose our potential in life. I can't. I'm afraid. What's going to happen to me? How can we overcome that fear in our life? Fear of failure. I think our Bible passage today has something insightful to say to us about that. Judges chapter 7, it's an epic Bible passage, a famous passage often referred to as Gideon's 300. The context for today's passage is that the Israelites had escaped slavery in Egypt and had now immigrated into Palestine. So as recent immigrants, they were vulnerable to the stronger surrounding nations, more established and more well-resourced. One of the chief enemies of the Israelites in their early days was the Midianites. The Midianites would often conduct raids into Israel. They'd let the Israelite farmers grow their crops and raise their livestock, and at the end of the season, after everything was harvested, the Midianites would swoop in and steal that hard-won harvest that you'd worked your entire summer for, leaving you bereft. And now, at the start of today's story, the Midianites have amassed on the border of Israel with thousands upon tens of thousands of troops, Midianites and their allies, and they're about to launch a full-scale invasion. God raises up the prophet Gideon, and Gideon puts out a call for volunteers. 32,000 Israelites volunteer to be part of this ad hoc fighting force. That's when the drama begins. Judges chapter 7, verse 2. The Lord said to Gideon, "Gideon, the troops with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into your hand." Say what, God? How can you ever go into battle with too many troops? Verse 3. The Lord said to Gideon, "Proclaim this in the hearing of the troops. Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home." So Gideon announced, "If you're fearful and trembling, go home." 22,000 of the 32,000 left. I think there's a powerful insight into the human psyche embedded in that. The implication of this passage is that two out of every three human beings lives a life controlled by fear. I believe it was Henry David Thoreau who once said most people live lives of quiet desperation. I mean, think of it. Two out of every three, 22 of 32,000. Think about what was going on in the life of those 32,000 people. They were Israelites who had seen the Midianites repeatedly swoop in and take the harvest that they had worked hard for. And now the Midianites were threatening to launch a full-scale invasion, pillaging, raping, stealing their children, taking them into slavery. Many Israelites were going to die. These 22,000, they were living miserable lives, and yet they chose to play it safe and hope for the best. They yielded to fear and they left. Verse 4. Then the Lord said to Gideon, "The troops are still too many," the 10,000 that were left. "Take them down to the water and I will sift them out for you." So Gideon leads the 10,000 that remain down to the riverbank and gives them a water break. The vast majority of the 10,000 troops end up drinking water there at the riverside the conventional way. Most of the 10,000 kneel on one knee, cup their hands in the water and draw the water up to their lips to drink. But a small percentage of them, 300 of them, did it differently. 300 of them, instead of kneeling and cupping their hands, fell onto their bellies, planted their face in the water, and lapped the water with their tongue like a dog. Verse 7. Then the Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 who lapped, I will deliver you and give the Midianites into your hand. Let all the others go to their homes." By now, Gideon must have been beside himself. "Come on, God. I started out with 32,000. You whittled it down to 10,000. Now you take my 10,000 and you subtract 9,700 out and you leave me with 300. What's so special about these 300 lappers?" The scripture text doesn't tell us, which means we're supposed to think about it. So I've been thinking about it, and I think I may be on to something. If I had been alive back then, if I had been part of that original 32,000 that gathered with Gideon, I know exactly which of these three groupings of troops I would have fallen into. I know for sure that I would not have been among the 22,000 who went away in fear and trembling. I would have been afraid, very afraid, but too afraid to admit that I was afraid. And so I would not have been one of the 22,000 who said, "I'm afraid, get me out of here." I would have stayed. I would have been one of the 10,000. But I also know for sure I would not have been one of the 300. I know for sure because, you see, I'm a conventional guy who does things the way you're taught, the way you're supposed to. So 9,700 of these 10,000 troops, they drank their water the way they had been taught, the polite, the respectful way, the conventional way. They knelt, they cupped the water, they brought it to their lips. That's the proper way, the appropriate way. And I'm a very appropriate person. The last thing I ever would have done would be to fall down on my belly, getting my clothes dirty and stained, and lapping the water. I'm a color in between the lines kind of guy. So I know for sure I would have been one of those who knelt, who cupped his hands, and drank the water, playing it safe, the conventional, the reasonable way of doing things. Do you remember when, several years ago, the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge was such a big phenomenon? You may recall that one of my brother-in-laws passed away to ALS a number of years ago now. And so when the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge came up, my sister Laurie, Bobby's wife, challenged our whole extended family to do the Ice Bucket Challenge. I intended to do it, but I hadn't got around to it yet. When one Sunday afternoon I was out at my other sister's house, much of the extended family was out at Melody's house, and as we were talking as a family, the Ice Bucket Challenge came up, and everybody started to say, "Oh, I did it, and I did it, and I posted it on Facebook, and Jeff, have you done it yet?" I hadn't done it yet. I intended to do it, but I had not yet done it yet. It turns out that of my whole extended family, just me and two of my nephews, Casey and Ty, had not yet done the Ice Bucket Challenge. So everybody got the great idea, "We know, we'll do the Ice Bucket Challenge for Jeff and Tyson and Casey today. Get ready." And so my nieces, all excited, rushed off to get this big cooler full of ice and water. And all the while I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, I want to do it, but I don't really want to do it, because when the water gets on me, my clothes will be soaking wet. And do you know how miserable it is to be in soaking wet clothes all afternoon?" And I hadn't brought a change of clothes with me. My sister said, "Oh, you can wear Mark's clothes, my other brother-in-law." And I'm thinking, is it just me, but isn't it kind of creepy to wear somebody else's clothes? So I didn't really want to do that either. And I was kind of anxious about this because I'd never had a whole bucket full of ice water poured over me before. It can't be a pleasant experience, right? So I'm thinking about this, and okay, I'm going to go along. I'm going to do it, but I'm anxious. Let's just get this over with. Meanwhile, my two nephews, Casey and Tyson, are like, "Hey, this is cool! Bring it on! This will be fun. We weren't planning to do this, but hey, we're spontaneous because they're all in anything goes kinds of personalities. And so we all lined up, the three of us, and the water was dumped over us. I endured the ice bucket challenge. My two nephews relished it. If I'd been at that riverbank with Gideon many thousands of years ago, I'm sure I would have been among the 9,700 who drank water in the contained, restrained, conventional, color within the lines way, but not my two nephews. They would have been among the 300, living life so large, so uninhibited, being such bold risk takers that they would have plopped on their bellies, got their clothes dirty, planted their face in the water, and lapped it up with their tongue like a dog. And those were the people God wanted, because God knew, I can do disproportionately great things with people who are like that. Give me the 300 lappers, the ones who are bold risk takers, a little bit crazy, willing to live on the edge. Now, don't get me wrong. I said a little bit crazy, not completely crazy, right? Because I don't believe the lesson of today's Bible story is that we should take crazy risk, foolish risk. I believe the lesson of today's Bible story is we should be willing to take bold, reasonable risk when God calls us, which is exactly what Gideon was doing. You see, Gideon had a plan. It was a bold plan. It was an unconventional plan, but he had a plan. His plan was to arm these 300, each with three weapons. Each of them would have three weapons with which to go into battle against the Midianites. They would have a torch, they would have a clay pot, and they would have, I had trouble with this in the first service, I'm having my Rick Perry moment. They would have a torch, they would have a clay pot, and they would have a, what? Trumpet. They would have a trumpet. He divided them into three groups of 100, three companies. And in the middle of the night, they snuck up on the encampment of the Midianites. 100 here, 100 over here, 100 over here. And as soon as Gideon gave the signal, simultaneously, all 300 of them shattered their clay pots, lifted their torches to the sky, blew their trumpets, and shouted at the top of their lungs, awakening the Midianites out of a deep sleep, creating the illusion that a massive army was about to attack them from three different directions. And in the panic and the confusion of the moment, the 30, 40, 50,000 Midianite soldiers started trampling each other and running for their lives, so that on that day, 300 special people, people who were not afraid to take a reasonable risk, people who were not afraid of the prospect of failure, they had the satisfaction of going down in history as being one of Gideon's 300 who liberated their people from the oppression of the Midianites, while those who were too fearful and those who were just a bit too cautious ended up sitting on the sidelines and watching and missing their chance at greatness in life. I believe there is a powerful lesson in this Bible story for you and me, and how we should approach fear of failure in our lives. The lesson being, if we want to live life to its fullest, if we want to achieve our full God-given potential, we cannot afford to be overly cautious, risk-adverse people. God is looking for people who are a little bit crazy. Crazy enough to be enthusiastic about taking bold, reasonable risks in the pursuit of great endeavors in life. The lesson of this Bible passage is, it's people who aren't afraid to fail who have the chance to accomplish the most in life. I remember a time in my life when I got this right for once. I've always had kind of a secret desire, a secret dream of being able to do ballet. But I never did it because of that. I figured, you know, people might laugh at me. People might make fun of me.
We will.
It might be a little awkward, you know. But then, a few years ago, I summoned the courage. Some of you remember this. It was at the church talent show a few years ago when I finally had my moment in the sun. Try to get that image out of your mind, huh? It seemed like a reasonable risk at the time. Actually, hopefully you know, I did not do this. This is a doctored picture, I swear. It's a doctored picture. But it does remind us of something very important. Not every reasonable risk leads to a positive outcome. That's why they call it risk. People who dare to take reasonable, bold risks in their life know that many times they will fail. It just goes with the territory. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. There's a famous Bible verse, 1 Corinthians 4:2, that puts it this way. It is required of stewards that we be found faithful. That word stewards, it's a reference to all of us. The idea is that God has entrusted us with the gift of life. And so we're expected to be good stewards of the gift of life, making the most of it, okay? God, how are we supposed to, how do you expect us to make the most of life? This verse tells us it is required of stewards that we be found faithful. Note, please, it does not say that we be found successful. It's that we be found faithful. That is a very important distinction. Think about it this way. In life, we often repeatedly find ourselves in a scenario, a three-part scenario that looks like this. There's some problem. There's some challenge that we are facing in our lives. So, step two, we take some action or inaction in response to that problem, and that leads to step three, an outcome. An outcome that can be either positive or negative. Growing up, most of us learned to define success by focusing on the third step in that sequence. Growing up, most of us learned that you are successful when you have positive outcomes, and you are a failure when you have negative outcomes in your life. But that way of looking at life is inconsistent with 1 Corinthians 4:2, because God doesn't say you must be found successful. God says, I want you to be faithful. That then shifts our focus from the third step in this sequence, outcome, to the middle step in this sequence, action. In response to my problem or challenge in life, did I act in a bold, reasonable way? If so, if I've acted faithfully in a bold, reasonable way, I am already a success in the eyes of God, regardless of the outcome. So that 1 Corinthians 4:2 and the example of Gideon's 300 challenge us to redefine what we mean by success as taking bold, faithful, reasonable risk in response to the problems of life, leaving the outcome to God. The problem with that first definition of success that focuses on outcome is it can paralyze us. It can cause us to pull back and say, I won't take any action unless I'm guaranteed of success, of a positive outcome. And we can't predict the future. Life's too complicated. Life's too confusing. And so we pull back and we start playing safe. We only do things when we're certain that we will succeed. And that means we miss all those other opportunities that God has laid before us, some of which will have a negative outcome, but many of which would have been positive outcomes. And so we end up truncating our God-given potential and being bad stewards of life when we focus on outcome instead of focusing on being faithful. Positive, bold, reasonable risk takers are the ones that end up living into their full God-given potential. When we begin to see life that way, we begin to realize that true failure is not trying. True failure is playing it safe. When we begin to see that, it liberates us to begin living as uninhibited, a little bit crazy, reasonable, risk-taking people who end up lapping like dogs at the waters of living, the waters of living water. Didn't get that one right, but you get the idea. We end up coming to the streams of living water and drinking deeply of those waters because we have not been afraid to fail. We've taken faithful risks for God. Let me give you an example from modern times of what it looks like to live that way. In his book, Passed Through the Fire, Rick Bunshu tells about how when he was visiting Hawaii on a vacation, everywhere he went, especially around the beaches, he was seeing the same bumper sticker on the back of vehicles and sometimes on surfboards. The bumper sticker read, "Eddie would go!" He saw this again and again, and so he asked about it. He learned that the bumper sticker was a reference to a guy named Eddie Aikau, who had been a legendary surfer and lifeguard on the dangerous north shore of Oahu, where apparently the waves are gigantic. Eddie had never seen a wave too big to back down. That's just how he approached life. He was all in, living large, never back down. As part of that ethic of living, Eddie volunteered to be a part of a project to construct a replica of an ancient Hawaiian sailing vessel, which they then attempted to sail from Hawaii to Tahiti. But as they were sailing through the channel of Hawaii, in the middle of the night, something went terribly wrong. There was a huge and unexpected storm, gale force winds, that capsized that sailing vessel, threw them all in the water. They were, of course, grasping hold of whatever was floating, whatever was around them, hanging together. They started shooting flares up into the night sky, hoping that a passing ship or a plane overhead would spot the wreckage and send help. But hours passed, and the darkness gave way to dawn, and still no one had noticed, no one knew that they were in trouble, and they knew that with the prevailing currents they would soon be washed out to sea so far that the probability that anyone would find them and rescue them was slim. So that's when Eddie swung into action. He had a plan. He had an idea. He said, "I'm going to leave you all here. I'm going to take my surfboard and I'm going to paddle up current the 12 miles to the nearest island to send back help." His friend said, "Eddie, don't do it. It's too risky. Play it safe. Hang here. We can hope that somebody will come by and save us." "No," he said, "I'm going to go." So he did. He set off with a necklace of oranges around his neck for food and liquid. With a strobe light and a surfboard, he set off, started paddling. Paddled, out of sight. That was the last anyone ever saw of Eddie Aikau. Soon after that, a ship did pass by and rescued the others, so they were able to tell the world what Eddie had done. That he had risked his life on a bold chance to save their lives. Now, if we were to evaluate that story through the lens of what we have been taught, how we have been taught to define success, we would say Eddie was a failure. The positive outcome he sought was not achieved. He was not able to rescue his friends, and in fact, he lost his life in the endeavor. But in God's eyes, Eddie Aikau was a brilliant success the moment he took faithful action and started paddling away on a reasonable risk to save his friends. With God, the emphasis is not on the outcome. It's on the faithful action. And now, Eddie Aikau has become a legend among surfers across the world when they find themselves in situations, whether on the water or in life, where they're tempted to pull back and play it safe. They will look each other in the eye and say, "Eddie would go. How about you?" What reasonable, bold risk is God calling you to in your life, but you've been pulling back and playing it safe? Eddie would go. How about you? This is how we need to reframe fear of failure through the eyes of faith. We need to get to that place where we say, I'm focusing on being faithful, faithful, bold, and reasonable. And when I do that, I'll leave the outcomes to God, because it's when I'm living that way that I unleash the full potential of my life. But before I finish, there's one other thing. I promised at the outset that we would look at least one spiritual weapon that we can bring against fear of failure. I mentioned a little bit ago that Gideon's 300 had three weapons. Actually, I was wrong. They had four weapons. They had their torch, they had their pitcher, they had their trumpet. But they also had an unseen weapon. It's called faith. Those 300 intuitively seemed to realize that in any situation, any challenge we face, there are the physical circumstances that surround us and seem to limit us. But then there is a whole level of spiritual reality that surrounds that physical reality, a spiritual reality that can impinge upon and affect and dramatically change that physical reality and the apparent physical limitations. They had faith. They seemed to anticipate thousands of years before the time of Christ the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 17, verse 20, where Jesus said, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will be able to say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. We call this possibility thinking. Now note what Jesus said here. Jesus did not say, and everything will be successful for you. He said, he flipped it. He said, nothing will be impossible. In other words, faith doesn't give us a guarantee that we're going to get a positive outcome every time we step out in faith. But faith does flip the equation in such a way that it makes all things possible. Not guaranteed, but possible. And if we don't step out in faith, we know it's not going to happen. That's possibility thinking. Gideon's 300 seemed to understand that if we step out in faith, we're going to unleash some incredible spiritual possibilities in this seemingly impossible situation. And what was true then is equally true in our world today. Case in point, December 1st, 1955, a 42-year-old woman, an ordinary woman who had worked a long day, boarded a bus in Montgomery, Alabama to head home. She sat down midway back the bus. A couple more stops and the bus filled up. So the bus driver got up and walked back halfway and said to Rosa Parks and a couple other people of color, you have to stand up and give your seat to the white people who have boarded the bus. Rosa Parks had been at some workshops and doing some training in civil disobedience and civil rights. She had been hearing stories of lynchings and the oppression of her people. On that afternoon, she says, I was tired. And she didn't mean physically. She meant I was tired in my soul of all this oppression. And so, to put it in Rosa Parks' own words, when that white driver stepped back toward us, when he waved his hand and ordered us up and out of our seats, I felt a determination cover my body like a quilt on a winter's night. Just as in our Bible story, the Spirit of the Lord took possession of Gideon. In that moment, the Spirit of the Lord took possession of Rosa Parks. And she said to that bus driver, I shall not be moved. Rosa Parks failed by the conventional definition of success. She was moved. She was arrested. She was convicted. But God took the little that ordinary person was able to offer, taking a bold, reasonable risk. God took that little and used it to catalyze the Montgomery bus boycott, which in turn was a catalyst in spawning the national civil rights movement. So that God took the little, a faithful, bold, reasonable action by one woman on December 1st, 1955, God took that and multiplied it and turned it into a catalyst that would change history forever. Still much progress to make, as we are reminded repeatedly these days, but so much progress made because one person acted like one of Gideon's 300, boldly and reasonably offered what she could to God. How about you? In your life, what bold, reasonable risk has God been calling you to dare to take, but you've been holding back and playing it safe? Eddie would go. Rosa Parks would go. Jesus went. Gideon's 300 went. How about you? Don't miss your God-given destiny. Step out in faith. Let me close with this. Ed McManus tells about a time his young son, Aaron, came home from summer church camp completely afraid of demons because at church camp, some of the older kids had been telling demon stories. And so that first night, Aaron was back at home. When it was time to tuck Aaron into bed, he was petrified. "Daddy," he said, "please leave the light on. Daddy, will you stay with me for a little while?" Edwin says, "I was about to say to my son what those kids told you. It wasn't accurate. It wasn't right." But he said, before I could get that out, my son had a third request of me. "Daddy, would you please pray that I'll be safe?" It's in that moment, Edwin says, that I realized that my son was being co-opted by what Edwin calls warm blanket Christianity. Safety, safety, safety. God, please keep me safe as life's highest objective. So in a moment of inspiration, Edwin McManus said to his little boy, "Aaron, I will not pray for your safety. Instead, I will pray that God will make you so dangerous that when you walk into a room, demons flee." As his little boy sat there absorbing this, little Aaron finally said, "Okay, Dad, but please pray that I'll be really, really dangerous." So that's what Edwin prayed. My prayer for you is not that you will be safe. My prayer for you is that you will be really, really dangerous. To the glory of God. Dare to live large. Never shrink back. Be one of Gideon.